I'm Bill Rice, and our session this morning is entitled Faith and Science, for lack of a better term. It's a very dry sounding subject, and I'm excited that so many of you have been attracted to it. And I hope that maybe before we're finished that some of you will come up with a catchier and more exciting title for what we're about, because I think that what we're about is going to be exciting. I'm curious, how many of you consider yourselves natural scientists or teach in the natural sciences or are career-wise involved in science? Oh, quite a number of you. Okay, and then how many of you are professionally involved in theology, teaching religion, or the church? Okay, so we have this is terrific. We're going to have some opportunities for some real dialogue and contribution. My own interest in the subject, and incidentally, I'm neither now a theologian nor a scientist, so I'm going to depend on you for a lot of more precise input during our discussion time. My interest in the area dates back to my high school days, and by the time I was beginning my senior year of high school, I had already decided I was going to be an astrophysicist, and I knew what that meant. And then in the middle of my senior year, things changed, and I began to feel a call towards the ministry. And then by the end of my senior year, I was trying to hold it together by saying, well, at least I'm going to bridge the gap between science and religion. And I thought I had it all put together. Well, I should have taught this course then, because I did have it together then, and since then it seems as though there are a lot more pieces, and it's a far more complex subject than I thought. There's been an interesting conference 2 years ago in Boston. Faith, Science, and the Future was the title of the conference. It was sponsored by the World Council of Churches. They came out with a two-volume report. This is the second volume, the smaller volume, which they entitled Faith and Science in an Unjust World. And they explore not only the relationship between the principles of science and the principles of faith, but more explicitly the relationship between science, pure science, and the technology which is dependent upon it, and the social issues of the world. These are issues which are too broad for us to tackle at the beginning of our session, although perhaps during our discussion at the end, if there are things that you want to work into, feel free. I'll just quickly give you a rundown of the contents. The nature of science and the nature of faith, humanity, nature, and God, science and education, ethical issues in the biological manipulation of life, technology, resources, environment, and population, all in one chapter, energy for the future, restructuring the industrial and urban environment, economics of a just, participatory, and sustainable society, science and technology, political power, and a more just world order, and towards a new Christian social ethic and new social policies for the churches. A fantastic undertaking, and this would make a terrific beginning for a more in-depth study. But what we'll do is we'll take 2 pages out of this, and only 2 pages, and spend an hour talking about 2 pages. We'll expand on them a bit. But those 2 pages explore, or just quickly map out, some of the models of the way in which science, pure science research, and our faith have been related in the past. But I'd like to begin with a model from the book of Proverbs that I think illustrates the mind of a scientist who is a man of faith. This is a vision which has the great objectivity and powers of observation that we associate with science, and yet also the sense of the awe and the wonder and the mystery which we associate with faith. Proverbs 30, 24 to 28. 4 things on earth are small, but they are exceedingly wise. The ants are a people not strong, yet they provide their food in the summer. The badgers are a people not mighty, yet they make their homes in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet all of them march in rank. The lizard you can take in your hands, yet it is in kings' palaces. And another two verses, 18 and 19. There are three things too wonderful for me, four I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. And in these six verses, we have the foundations of all the physical, biological, sociological sciences, and still they are spoken with the vision of faith. We may get back to that later. Now, looking at the various ways of relating these two things, the first, perhaps, that comes to our mind is a model that says science alone is a valid system or a valid discipline for understanding our world. That faith was adequate at one time, but faith is based on superstition. We cannot really verify scientifically any of the story of creation. Science is adequate for not only discovering truth, but for pointing the directions that we ought to go in further research and in technological application. Now, this is probably a viewpoint that many of our colleagues share, those who really consider religion to be superstition and consider the activities of the church to be ancient traditions, harmless at best. How many of you work with colleagues who would say that they are agnostics or certainly would have nothing to do with the religious faith? Okay. Now, the curious thing about this is, number one, that it could be a consistent and a coherent position, that it could be a position which is applied universally in life, and yet it isn't. For I think if you think of those same colleagues, they have fallen in love with a person of the opposite sex, perhaps they've gotten married. I'm sure they didn't evaluate that situation on scientific principles. They may have children. They may have made sacrifices for their children, which were not based on a very careful delineation of the probabilities that their children would be able to repay those sacrifices in the future. In other words, in their private and their personal lives, they are not operating on a strictly rationalistic scientific basis, even though they may proclaim that they do. And in times of extreme crisis, death of a close family member, these same people will be searching for and relying on answers which are not provided in their scientific discipline. Corollary to that, of course, is those who would say that science is hogwash, science is anti-biblical, and that faith alone is a discipline, or faith alone is adequate to sustain us through life, and that faith alone is able to answer all of our questions about life. It is able to organize our society. It is able to provide the answers that we need in our own technology. And I've raised that question, technology, because it is these people who you will most often encounter in a situation like this. There is someone close to them who has become very ill, perhaps has a terminal disease, and they have been from doctor to doctor, from clinic to hospital, and there seems to be no hope or very little hope. At which point, members of the family or friends or members of their church group have supported them with prayer. They've been supported by their whole church with prayer, and they have experienced a dramatic and miraculous recovery which has the doctors baffled. And this is often perceived then as a victory of the principles of faith over the principles of science. What science cannot do, that faith can do. Now, while there are many people who do feel this way, and who within their churches feel very much personally supported and strengthened and affirmed in their faith by the victory of prayer over the applications of science and technology, it should not be lost on us that most people who are in medicine are just as much in awe and excited by the possibility of, or the role of, faith within the healing process. They are just as much in awe of healing, even within their discipline, as those who see faith healing as a disproving of scientific principle. Anytime you want to jump into this and contribute an illustration, feel free to do so. A third way that science and faith have been related is to say that they deal with totally separate realities. They don't really have anything to do with each other. Our faith proclaims to us our redemption. It concerns itself with theological and religious issues. It concerns itself with the spiritual matters of life, whereas science deals with the material aspects of life. And so we can be a perfectly good, rational, hard-nosed scientist without any illusions about the world, 6 days a week, because we are dealing with the material and the physical world. We can ask all sorts of questions about this world, why it operates the way it does, how it operates, where it came from, where it's going, and so on and so forth. And then on Sunday morning, we can go to church, and without any apology, and without any feeling of incongruity, be hearing stories of God's action in history, and of God's activity on behalf of certain people, and of miraculous events and healings, and so on and so forth. And we can feel very spiritually uplifted. Come Monday, we put the spirits back in the box and we get nature out again. And essentially this solution says that we live in the natural world, but our spirits are with God. And since spirits, of course, are the important thing, then we are concerned with the status of our spirit in the realm of faith. And never the two, the natural world or the spiritual, shall meet. Now that's a solution that most of us would not accept either, because that allows no possibility that our faith would say anything about the natural world. It certainly would never give us a mandate to go into the world and do anything with it. It certainly would have nothing to tell us about how we should care for the earth or how we should care for each other. And so there's another solution. And that is that to say that faith and science really are dealing with the same world. We live in one world. We're not split into spirit and body, but we are one. But there are different ways of asking questions about this world. And science asks the how question. Well, faith asks the why question. Take creation, for example. Science asks, how did it happen? And so through our study of the evolution of biology and and geology and physics and so on, we begin to lay out a time frame of 5 billion years or so from the formation of the Earth, and we can begin to plot out how the Earth cooled and how it was formed and how the first amino acids were formed and how they probably linked up with each other and how unicellular organisms developed, and so on and so on and so forth. And we come up with a description of a process. And science stops right there, dead in its tracks. Whereupon faith takes over and says, well, why would God ever do a thing like that? And then we look at something like the story of Genesis, and we no longer ask, is it accurate in terms of the how of creation? But we say, what are the meanings now that we see in the creation stories? And Charlie has been elucidating those for us yesterday. What are the meanings in this story that talk about God's reason for the creation of the world? Why are we here? Why is the world here? What is our role in the world? It's interesting that this particular view handicaps both men of faith and men of science. In the sciences, it's probably easiest to see that a scientist or one who is applying the principles of science can carry those principles out fairly well as long as they are merely deriving following through the logical deductions from a given scientific theory. You can take axiomatic principles and ask, how would these things be expressed in the natural world, and explore the natural world to see if they are indeed confirmed. But the great scientific theories, those that have caused revolutions in the scientific community, are ones which have dabbled in the question of why as well as the question of how. So that this particular solution is a solution, if you'll pardon my being very harsh, is a solution for little minds. Science is not content merely to describe how something is happening. We have in the field of physics now a great number of extremely difficult theoretical and analytical questions having to do with the possibility of multiple universes which are concurrent. If you read the serious writings in the theory of physics today, you'll think that you are reading metaphysical writings coming out of the Middle Ages. There was a very serious article in Scientific American a few months ago, which is about as technical as I can get because I haven't kept up with my science, about the anthropic principle. And it raised the question, with all of the possible ways in which the world and the universe could have been formed, if we look at the universe as we know it, it is extremely specific. The polypeptide chains that go together to make up most of our enzymes are quite similar to each other. If you look at the biochemistry of DNA and RNA and the enzymes of all of the living material on this planet, you'll find that it is highly complex and highly uniform, that we don't have a wide variety of different models of life, but we have one model of life, extremely specific, and yet, theoretically, not the only one that could have been. Questions get raised then as to why is this universe so specific in the way it is formed in the area of astronomy. Same question gets raised, thinking of the moments right at and after the Big Bang. Extremely tiny variations in the distribution of the density of matter would have caused dramatic differences in the way our universe would appear today. And the particular way in which densities are arranged in our universe, that is, we have clusters of galaxies, and we have galaxies, and we have star clusters, and so on, and the very fact that gaseous matter has been sufficiently ununiform, that there have been loci so that condensation could occur, and galaxies could form, and stars could form, and planets could form. The tiniest variations within the primordial universe would have caused a totally different setup. And so the questions have been raised, why do we have the universe we do? Now these are serious physicists raising these why questions. And out of that they've come the anthropic principle, which we may discuss a little later, but I don't want to get... Are you all with me so far? Okay, we'll drop that to the point, except to say that science is not content to stick with how, nor is faith content to stick with why. Because within our faith we say some very specific things about how the universe is set up and how human institutions are set up. We're not merely content to leave that to the scientists and say, well, you set up the society and we'll tell you why it should be that way. Now there is another approach. It's a very difficult approach. I'll call it interacting. And that is to say that faith informs science and science informs faith. St. Paul talked about the good that I would do, I do not do, and the evil I abhor, that's the very thing that I do. We see strong parallels in that in Freudian's discussion of the id. In fact, in all psychoanalytic theories, we see this, we have explanations of this terrific power within us not to do that which we would will. There are conflicting persons within us. This approach, the interaction of faith and science, would say that our discoveries within the psychoanalytic field have been prompted in part by the faith of the church, which has understood what Paul meant. That is, Paul's statements have pointed us to look with our analytical, rationalistic, scientific eyes at a phenomenon of human life that we would not have looked at otherwise, and which, with our tools of science, we've now analyzed, and in turn, that our analysis informs our faith. The same argument could be said that scientific study of Bible lands has revealed a great deal about the nature of the times in which Scripture was written, and also Scripture itself. And so Scripture has been elucidated by scientific study. There are some problems with this because the approach, the interaction of faith and science seems to occur at only minute and sporadic places, and it may be kind of a stretching, a wishful thinking to say that truly science and faith do interact and inform and contribute to each other. But there is one marvelous, there are a number of marvelous writers who have written somewhat with that orientation, and Lauren Isley is one. Are any of you familiar with his immense journey? I see a few nods. I'll give you a taste of this vision. Lauren Isley is walking through the forest, and he comes upon a glade. He says, I had sat down to rest with my back against a stump. Through accident, I was concealed from the glade, although I could see into it perfectly. The sun was warm there, and the murmurs of forest life blurred softly away into my sleep. Put you all to sleep with this. When I awoke, dimly aware of some commotion and outcry in the clearing, the light was slanting down through the pines in such a way that the glade was lit like some vast cathedral. I could see the dust motes of wood pollen in the long shaft of light, and there on the extended branch sat an enormous raven with a red and squirming nestling in its beak. The sound that awoke me was the outraged cries of the nestling's parents, who flew helplessly in circles about the clearing. The sleek black monster was indifferent to them. He gulped, wetted his beak on the dead branch a moment, and sat still. Up to that point, the little tragedy had followed the usual pattern. But suddenly, out of all that area of woodland, a soft sound of complaint began to rise. Into the glade fluttered small birds of half a dozen varieties, drawn by the anguished outcries of the tiny parents. No one dared to attack the raven, but they cried there in some instinctive common misery, the bereaved and the unbereaved. The glade filled with their soft rustling and their cries. They fluttered as though to point their wings at the murderer. There was a dim, intangible ethic he had violated, and they knew he was a bird of death. And he, the murderer, the black bird at the heart of life, sat on there, glistening in the common light, formidable, unmoving, unperturbed, untouchable. The sighing died. It was then I saw the judgment. It was the judgment of life against death. I will never see it again so forcefully presented. I will never hear it again in notes so tragically prolonged. For in the midst of protest, they forgot the violence. There in that clearing, the crystal note of a song sparrow lifted hesitantly in the hush. And finally, after painful fluttering, another took the song, and then another, the song passing from one bird to another, doubtfully at first, as though some evil thing were being slowly forgotten, till suddenly they took heart and sang from many throats joyously together, as birds are known to sing. They sang because life is sweet and sunlight beautiful. They sang under the brooding shadow of the raven. In simple truth, they had forgotten the raven, for they were the singers of life and not of death. Isn't that a beautiful melding together of a vision informed by faith and a vision informed by science? We've only just begun. Another approach is to say that faith and science are conceptual languages. In the same sense that we know a language is a very formative part of our culture, you've probably all heard the illustration of how the Eskimos have over 20 words for snow. Words that describe hard-packed snow and falling snow and large crystals and small crystals and so on and so forth. The fact that there are that many words in the language is indicative of the fact that the Eskimos perceive a greater range of nuances of snow than we do. The language bears the possibility of talking about and therefore representing to ourselves an image and a vision of snow more specific and more complete than what we in our English language can do. In the same way, science and faith are languages. They are conceptual languages. In our language of faith, we have symbols and images and words that refer to God, His purpose, His people, to creation, to Jesus, Jesus the Christ. We have the image and the symbols of the cross, and we talk of redemption, propitiation, salvation, grace. And these concepts, and the language of faith then, provides the possibility for us to talk about our world and our experience in a way that elicits powerful meanings. Meanings which are there in the real world, but meanings which are only elicitable through our language. Now, Lee, you're going to take me on that one. I can see it coming. Science, in the same way, however, is a language. And science talks about hypotheses. And analysis, and so on. And I think that you can see where we're going, because faith is not a testable hypothesis. So the language of science is able to open up a great number of possibilities. The language of science suggests to us where we might look, what types of hypotheses we might set up and test, and if those, and depending on how they're tested and the results, we form new hypotheses and so on. But science would have a great deal of difficulty testing the hypothesis of faith without taking that and turning it into something else. So, again, we can move from one language into another language. And yet we've got a real problem, because how do two different languages interact with each other? How then, as scientists, do we speak of our faith? And how, as men of faith, do we grapple with a scientific world? I guess the greatest problem with this is not only that we cannot talk to each other, or that is, we can't even talk within ourselves, thinking of faith and science as language systems, but that neither one becomes very authoritative. If faith is merely a language, is there truly the event of grace happening in our world and in ourselves? Or is it merely a figment of our imagination, which we have generated by this internal mental game that we share? Shall we go on to another? You're all waiting for the solution. I can see it. I'm not sure this is the best term for this category, but it's It's where we'll begin. Perhaps you can help me come up with a term later on. Concept that faith and science are similar types of things. They are disciplines. And that each has an element of faith within it, and each has a discipline, science, within it. Bishop Anselm, in his writing, Cur Deus Homo, Why God Became Man, states, faith seeks understanding, and this pretty much becomes a dictum of Anselm's, which he repeats again and again and again. That which we know unequivocally, faith, seeks understanding within our minds. That which we cannot deny must be made intelligible to us. So we begin with faith, and then theology and biblical study and so on, but theology in particular is the explication or the explanation or the rationalization or the making intelligible to ourselves of what we know unequivocally. Probably all of us have experienced the love of a parent or the love of another person for which we had no doubt or question in our mind. The thought never occurred to us, does that person love us? That would be the faith component. And yet, that needs some kind of explanation. Why do my parents love me? Or why does this other person love me? What is behind that? What is the cause of that? Why is it dependable? And through all the questioning and all the explanation and all the theology that may be expressed to explain why that is possible, it does not shatter the event of the knowledge that it is there. So that faith has this component of faith within it, and then a science or a discussion to make rational and to make intelligible to ourselves what it is that we know unequivocally. And science does the same. When Heisenberg came out with his uncertainty principle in physics, which is a way of saying that no event could be measured, and at the same time, or you could never say what the velocity and what the location of a subatomic particle was at any given moment. The event of observing a subatomic event changed that event. And so you could only speak, and I see someone smiling here, is probably going to correct me on this later. I welcome that. As I understand it, you could only speak in terms of probabilities that a particular subatomic particle was in a particular location at a particular time. And the entire mathematics of physics then has been revolutionized to measure events, subatomic events, in terms of probabilities and the interaction of probabilities. Well, when Einstein, who was considerably older than Heisenberg, learned of this trend of thought, he said it was hogwash. He totally could not accept that. That it was implying that there was nothing specific and definite about the universe. If we can only talk about the universe in probabilities, this was a direct counter to a principle of his faith. For Einstein has said, and you've heard this quotation, I'm sure, God does not play dice with the universe. And I think all people in the physical sciences have fundamental faith positions, faith in the intelligibility of the world, that we do have the capacity to learn what is out there. Faith in the dependability of the world, that it will follow certain principles, certain laws, and certain rules. Faith in our ability to determine what those principles and rules are. Faith in the reliability that those rules are not going to change in midstream, or that they aren't going to change between here and the sun and the nearest star. And it is on those faith stances that the exercise of science is based. So the discipline of science has its faith component, and it has a discipline which then
seeks to examine and to make intelligible and to draw out the consequences and the implication of certain faith stances.
The only trouble with this, of course, is having said that, that both faith and science are confessional disciplines which begin with unshakable premises. We still haven't shown a relationship between them. We've just said that they're similar. How are we doing on time? We're going to have to race through here. Thomas Kuhn has written a book, I believe it's entitled The Anatomy of Scientific Revolutions, which illustrates this characteristic of science as a discipline very clearly. For Kuhn shows that science does not merely progress with the gradual and the continual widening of the boundaries of knowledge. We discover new things here and new things there and so on and so forth. But rather, he shows very clearly in all disciplines where a unified theory within that discipline holds sway for a period of time and directs research. And then anomalies within the discoveries within that research begin to accumulate and change within the science. The change of an understanding or vision occurs only with a great deal of stress and tension. It occurs in the form not of a gradual evolution and opening up of knowledge, but of a throwing out of a whole idea. Think, for example, of the Ptolemaic system, which had the Earth at the center of the universe, and how over the centuries the Ptolemaic system was refined and polished. The process of science was to show how the mathematics of the spheres revolving around the Earth could account for the heavenly motions as observed by the human eye and by telescopes. And this involved wheels within wheels. It involved circles. Our term, the music of the spheres, comes from visions of the revolving circles of these in the Ptolemaic system. Until the universe had to be enormously complex to account for the observed movements of the planets in the heavens. The Copernican revolution threw that entire bit of mechanics out the window entirely and placed our sun in the center of the solar system, and we began over again. Newtonian mechanics had a similar revolution, underwent a similar revolution with the theories of relativity. And although we can still utilize it on a day-to-day basis, in any field of science where extremes of motion and density and energy are concerned, Newtonian physics is now essentially out the window. Let's try integrating the two. Now, after some of the things we've said, this will sound both hopeful and possibly simplistic. The integration model of the relationship between science and faith says that science informs our faith and faith informs our science, and that actually in such a way in which, as we proceed, they will be seen to be confirming and verifying each other. On a simplistic level, think of the discovery on Mount Ararat of pieces of petrified wood that seem to be possibly associated with the Ark, with the Noah's Ark. How many of you read of that, the discoveries of Noah's Ark? Okay. Great victory for this viewpoint. It says science confirms the Bible. We now know there was a flood and there was a Noah and there was an ark, and the whole story is absolutely true, just the way it was told in the Bible, because science proves it. The corollary to this is that our faith then should inform our science and should confirm our science. And there are those now who are studying the black holes, who say that the black holes find their verification in hints in the book of Revelation. I can remember when in the late 50s,
there was some discovery of a red spot on the moon, which later turned out to be an artifact, but it hit the papers. There was a red spot on the moon, and some Christian communities immediately felt, this is it. This is the confirmation of that the moon shall turn to blood, and the prophecies of Revelation, and we've got the end time coming, and that whole syndrome. Nevertheless, the principle was there that science would indeed confirm all of those strange and peculiar things that we've discovered in, or that are spoken of in Scripture. The anthropic principle, which I mentioned a little bit earlier, as an attempt to explain why our universe is as specific as it is and as uniformly specific, says that perhaps a prerequisite for the formation of the universe is that that universe would evolve in such a way that life would evolve, and life of a conscious nature would evolve, life that could reflect upon the universe. In other words, no universe could exist unless it would result in life which would be able to look back on it and reflect on it, and by reflecting upon it, make it real. The anthropic principle is related by some theoreticians to the whole biblical understanding of God's creation, particularly God's creation of man and the necessity of there being man, the self-conscious being within the universe, to understand it and to husband it. I have trouble with the integration model myself, but it is one of the models. And I think I'm going to leave them right there, because those are the only ones that I can come up with. And just open it up now and see how you would like to struggle with this and contribute to it.
Can I be the guinea pig?
Shoot.
Well, you asked for a new name. I see, I don't know why you would downgrade science and downgrade faith. And they're components that we have to face. They're God-given, I think. And God gave us a mind to see the things, so they would stay the same. But what I'd like to ask is, how that a guy like me, I think about the best example of a totally unscientific mind you could ever run into. I've got a little bit of faith, and I kind of know a little about that. But how can you people make me comfortable so that I can accept the two, because I think two are in integration, whether you have trouble with it or not. And why does the scientific world tend to shut its mind to the theological world, and why does the theological world tend to shut its mind to the scientific? I'm talking about the guys in the ivory towers. When there's validity in both, or is there no validity in either one?
I think that most of us probably would feel that there is validity in both, unless we opt for the first two positions, which delight in seeing the other side get knocked down. And I guess the real question is, how do we then relate those two, and how do we accomplish exactly what you're talking about? Breaking that separation of disciplines so that we have people who are scientists and we have people who are theologians and they have difficulty talking with each other. That's exactly the issue. How do we bring those together?
Well, is it true that I read and hear and am told that more and more scientists who once were totally, I wouldn't say opposed, but totally feeling no validity whatever in theological view of the world, are coming more and more to have a Christian faith, men who are agnostic, to, at best is not atheist in their thoughts concerning religious life and faith, and as they delve into the things, and that there were a couple of men who set out scientifically to prove the Bible totally wrong, and on their own, in reading it, came to the Christian faith. Is that true?
I don't know, someone like to respond?
Well, in my family, I have a son-in-law who is a space scientist. And Bob, although he admits that he has had lots of questions, you know, he has a strong faith. He's the head of a large division of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Tennessee. And I like to discuss these things with him. And he has recommended things to read. For instance, how many of you have read Harvard astronomer Harlow Shapley's book, View from a Distant Star? I think there's, although he doesn't deal specifically with faith, he deals with man's place in the universe. And I found that a very interesting little book to read. But, like I say, Bob doesn't seem to have, although he admits he has a lot of questions about things in the Bible. But he has a strong faith.
Yes.
Yeah, I've listened to all of this and I really need to know, what do you mean by faith? I don't know what you're talking about when you say faith and what you say science. How would you define faith?
Okay, I think maybe the reason that's been confusing is because as we've looked at the models of relating these, which are our traditional ways in which people have brought them together, their very understanding of what faith is and what science is changes as the model changes. We use the word in a couple of senses. One is the sense of the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. That is that on which we base our lives and cannot and do not question because it is the ground on which we stand. And for a Christian, this is faith in Christ, and faith in what Christ did on the cross and what that and that action is effective for us as a society, and it's effective for us as individuals and as a community. And we also use the word faith in saying that that same sense of faith could also be a part of an understanding of science, and that the pursuit of science itself can only occur if one makes certain assumptions, an assumption that what I see before me as some relationship to reality, that the universe is somehow consistent, that there are some reasonable rules to the universe, that it's intelligible, these sorts of things.
Okay, faith is things that you can't prove, science is things that you can prove.
Not necessarily.
Perhaps
you can't
some of
prove all of the scientific things. It's a method of looking at things. Science, each of them look at things in a different way. And I think that Bill brought it out, that science is after things that you can test. And faith, you accept things that you cannot test, that don't have any way of testing. And the issue, I think, is... I think
you mean your faith is never tested?
No, I'm talking about you test the validity by certain materialistic things. Science deals with material issues, and faith deals with things that are not in the material realm.
I'm not quite sure what's behind your question. I think that might be helpful if you could explain a little bit more what you're after.
You know, you're talking about faith there, and what do you mean by that? Things that you can't, things that you believe in?
Yes. That which you believe in, which is so fundamental to you that you base everything else upon it, you ask your other questions around it. It is Job having faith in that God would answer him, that God was reliable, that God was there, that God was just. Having such faith in that he was willing to discredit all of the other explanations and arguments for why he was suffering, because that was his rock.
Well, it seems to me, in my struggle here, that is exactly the core. It's right there that even to put faith in science on the same blackboard is inappropriate, as far as I'm concerned, in one sense. The one is foundational and was before science ever came, and we're dealing with a cosmology and an approach and a methodology of asking questions that's in its diapers. When we're talking about faith, the testimony of our belief system, of our confidence in a God that has been revelatory, is just a transcendent sort of a reality that we embrace. And when we come then and see how in the opening of his hand, he allows us to know. This is an old argument in counseling and psychotherapy. Do you have to have insight in order to have healing? And most of us have said no. Insight sustains healing. Insight can attest to the way that you got healed, and you can do some things to sustain that. So insight can be helpful, but it's not essential. So when we're looking at, for me, for my profession of the reality of Jesus Christ, that is an essential thing for me to know. How many books I read or how many outcome studies I'm cognizant of is an option. Pleasant, helpful, informative, may help me to be both a better Christian, a better witness to the faith, a better physician, a better psychiatrist, but not essential to my relationship with God. The facts, in other words, are not in the same league as relationships. And the story of our faith is a relationship story. It's a relationship paradigm. And the fact acquisition that fits into that relationship paradigm is for me a helpful sort of a thing, but not essential. And that's what I meant by almost two different blackboards to discuss the thing. And one of the reasons that we get in a hassle about it is because we try to put it on the same blackboard. And for me, that took a long struggle when people were trying to talk to me about science as being a surrogate for faith. And that's been most of my experience as a professional, is which God do you worship? And when it's put up that way, then immediately I'm asked to choose, you know, choose this day between God and man. Mm-hmm. Now that's an unfortunate splitting, I believe. Mm-hmm. The choice is unequivocal. I choose God or do not choose God. And then I see the things of the flesh just as the gifts of God. Every one of them are corruptible when I lose sight of the edification of the body in relationship. So that the outcomes of science and the knowledges or the blowing up of one scientific theory and the switching over to another and another approach, all of those things come and go. And my knowledge increases, or my darkness comes over the world for 500 years. But the faith thing still is in place. The revelatory versus the discovery. And if we truly believe that all of life issues from the hand of God, then the how questions of how it issues are very provocative and interesting. Not essential for me to know in that I'm living and breathing. I don't have to know cardiology to have a heart that pumps. It's helpful. I mean, I can be helpful to myself and others in that. But it seems to me that unless those distinctions have been made for me, in other words, I have said, for me, faith stands. I mean, that is something that I can't defend. I really can't, because in any scientific inquiry, my faith is an absurdity. It can be reduced by a sharp line. It was said of Nietzsche, the thing he could argue every Christian ever came up against. But the thing that bugged him to his dying days is that he couldn't wipe the smile off their face when they died. And it seems to me we're dealing with different dimensions of reality. And we've had the unfortunate occurrence, I think, to move into the age of enlightenment and rationalism and laws of parsimony and unipolar hypothesis, which have been very helpful in discovering factual relationships of how things run. But that same cosmology then has done violence to a total reality which embraces the spiritual, the numinous, with all the inquiry into that.
How then can I, whose faith is, as you illustrated, relate to the scientific, which is fact, which is here? And how do I accept that? And what mood do I accept it? How do I deal with it from an unscientific mind?
I think that you can either embrace it knowledgeably and say, gee, that's stuff that I would like to know. That's stuff that I feel can be helpful and edifying to me in my pilgrimage. Or you can say, that stuff, here we get into a whole other alley that we haven't had a chance, and that's the ethics of science. Or you can say, science has gone off as a giant on its own, and it has become as a bucking horse, or a stiff-necked or a wayward people. And it has worshipped the God of progress and change, in that sense, and has said, yep, all which comes to light is for the betterment.
That comes out of a mentality of humanistic positivism that's been very popular for several hundred years. The upward and onward, bigger is better. The new and the more the discoveries, the better humankind is going to be. Better things, for better living through science. You can say to that, on the other hand, no. I don't buy it. I think their ethics are rotten. I think that it's really a seduction, and you can close your mind off. I think that either of those would be unfortunate. But finally, when pitch comes to putt, it seems to me that faith has to direct, in its at its best, the opening of the hand in the scene. That's one of the things that has become our portion, is the knowledge of good and evil. And so that when things come out, if we don't do ethics on that and say, this will lead to greater good in relationship, this will lead probably to greater evil in relationship, and we have not been, if one has no ethical posture, then I'd be hard put to say whether science has been blessing or curse.
But I hear you saying something a little bit more there, not only that science is not in the position to be answering those ethical questions, or that science is not a field in itself where it can set up its own ethics and direct, but that it is subservient to an ethic and to an understanding of life which is based upon our fundamental faith. And I would pursue that, but I would say as well that it isn't merely a curiosity. I would see science not as merely a curiosity that it's fun to play with now that we have our faith in God and we have our security in God, and it's nice to see how he put his world together. Isn't that fun? Isn't that pretty? But I would see it a bit further, as though scientific inquiry is also mandated by our faith, in the same sense in which Job was praised, and getting back to Job now, it wasn't enough for Job to simply say, well, I believe in God, so whatever happened to me, I'm just going to accept it, period. Now, he challenged that. He said, this does not make sense. Making sense is what science is about. It doesn't make sense because it does not follow from, it's not deductible from what I understand of what I have faith in God's justice being. And therefore I'm going to wrestle with it, and I'm going to wrestle with him. And I'm going to come up against these awesome and these terrifying anomalies of life. And I think that the great scientists do have this great sense of awe that they're coming up against something terribly, terribly complex.
But go on with Job, as long as you pick Job. He says, finally, after I've heard your arguments, Job, where were you when I put it all together? And then comes up with his final testimony. Though he slay me, though all of this stuff go awry, yet I will bless his name. I mean, finally, then, the kind of wrestling that goes on in there is a wrestling anchored in faith. That's what I'm saying. The first word and the final word are faith words. The in-between words, in their most provocative and explorative way, can be scientific words. I'm really fascinated with science and all that we're opening up to. I don't mean to come off as sounding as if that I would personally choose to. All right, science is connectedness with God. Great. And that, with that sort of purview, then I can read the humanists in psychiatry. I can read about the interactions of the mind and embrace of Freud or Glasser or a thousand other people who've got ideas, and cut and choose and select and affirm within that. But finally, that's within the wrestling connectedness of that. That's neat.
Okay. Are we having two sessions for dinner?
Yes.
Okay, well, I think we've just about used up our time. Thank you very much.